Bullets on the Border, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. A U.S. Border Patrol agent fired shots through the border fence in Nogales, Arizona.
16 shots total in 34 seconds.
Those shots killed a teenager on the Mexican side, but an Arizona jury says it wasn't murder. Also, President Trump famously called Mexican immigrants rapists and bad hombres. This immigration historian rejects Trump's rhetoric.
He was talking about individuals who I had interviewed personally, who had come to work, made some mistakes, fallen in love. All of this nuance of humanity was being lost.
Plus, Kenyans scramble to escape widespread flooding.
Where the rivers are breaking banks, people have to climb on top of trees to make the phone calls that would save their lives.
Those stories today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. It's good to have you here on this Tuesday.
No justice!
No peace!
No justice!
No peace!
That was downtown Tucson, Arizona yesterday. Dozens of people outside the federal courthouse there to rally against the acquittal of a Border Patrol agent. That agent, Lonnie Swartz, was charged in the 2012 fatal shooting of a Mexican teenager on the other side of the border. 16-year-old Jose Antonio Elena Rodriguez allegedly threw rocks at Swartz as he and other agents tried to confront drug smugglers at the border. Michelle Marisco is a reporter with public radio station KJZZ in Phoenix, and he says to really understand this case, we need to start at the section of the U.S.-Mexico border where this incident played out, in Nogales, Arizona.
This is a very unique section of the border. Here, Mexico is actually about 20 to 30 feet lower in elevation than Nogales, Arizona. And then on top of that, you have the 36-foot bollard-style wall.
Bollards are like these steel posts. I mean, they go up like 35 feet in the air, right?
Exactly. They go down 6 feet, and then they go up about 30 feet. Down below, these young people were trying to throw these rocks over the fence and landing on top of these agents in order to keep them from making this arrest. Agent Swartz went up to the bollards with his Glock semi-automatic pistol. He unloaded 3 rounds. He stopped. He reloaded. He fired again, then fired again. 16 shots total in 34 seconds, all centered around the same victim, Jose Antonio, the 16-year-old boy.
Did prosecutors pursue the angle of unwarranted force? You know, drug smugglers throwing rocks versus a Border Patrol agent with a 9mm Glock.
They did. You know, what they said was that, yes, they're not going to dispute that the teenager was throwing rocks, but that is not a death sentence, and neither is smuggling drugs. The jury obviously felt that this was not quite the case, and they ended up siding with the Border Patrol agent.
So we'll get into the verdict in a moment, but this is not the first incident involving Border Patrol agents using lethal force. Why did this case spark such protests?
Part of it was the fact that, and I think this is very important, that the United States or the defense never said for years that the boy was actually actively involved in trying to help these drug smugglers. That didn't come out until a year ago. So for 5 years, we were always told by the family, by everyone else, that the boy was walking home and that he was an innocent bystander. It wasn't until a year ago that a different reality started to come out. So that was the first case. The second was the length of the attack, the fact that the agent unloaded his gun, then stopped, reloaded, walked over to another area of the border wall, pointed his gun between the bars again, 30 feet down, and unloaded more shots onto this teenager.
So can you give us a sense of the scene in the courthouse yesterday after the verdict was announced? How did the family of Jose Antonio Rodriguez respond?
His mother left before the verdict was even announced, and his grandmother walked out, and she was in tears. His brother was shaking visibly. They didn't want to talk to anybody. They were so distraught. The prosecutors were upset. Assistant U.S. Attorney Wallace Clendens challenged the jury's decision on this and said that on May 11, he's going to try this again. He's going to try to bring back at least a manslaughter charge against Agent Swartz.
We gather that immigrant advocate groups are also upset by the verdict. But I'm just curious, what did you hear from Border Patrol agents? Are they standing up for Agent Swartz, or are you noticing a divide?
There is no divide. The agents were really enthusiastic. Here's a Border Patrol local union president, Art Del Cueto, talking about what this decision means.
The bottom line is you had individuals that were committing a crime. They were attacking a federal agent. The federal agent defended himself and defended the other agents. He did the right thing. That's all I can say.
So, Michel, if the narrative now goes that the 16-year-old was smuggling drugs, is there a jury in Arizona that would convict at this point?
I don't think so. I mean, this jury was already at odds with itself on Friday. They came back on Monday with this decision. Traditionally, Border Patrol agents facing corruption charges don't get away with those. But when it comes to this type of killing, it seems to be that juries are just squeamish about attributing murder to a potential self-defense case like this one.
Michel Marisco, reporter with public radio station KJZZ, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you, Marco.
Migration to the U.S. has faced increased scrutiny under the Trump administration, but in some ways, especially when it comes to Mexico, what's happening now only reflects the latest shift in years of back and forth between the U.S. and Mexico. It's a reality that's put into context in a new book titled Undocumented Lives. The World's Monica Campbell spoke with the book's author.
Ana Raquel Minian grew up in Mexico City, was interested in the world, politics, but to learn more about her own country, she decided she needed to study its ties to the U.S., so she started digging.
I began the book in 1965, a year after the United States ends the Bracero program.
Many field crops still call for stoop labor, especially at harvest time, when demand for labor is at its peak. It isn't easy to find men willing to take on such undesirable kinds of work.
This was a program that started as a result of the Second World War, when American men were going to fight abroad and were part of the army. So the United States needed more people working in the United States. And one of the ways that it found this manpower was by bringing Mexicans to work in the fields.
The Bracero program ends in 64. But people from Mexico still want to work in the U.S., people like Gregorio Casillas, who Minian interviewed for her book.
Gregorio Casillas was born in a small rancho. It was approximately two streets wide.
He saw his father go to the U.S. as part of the Bracero program in the 50s.
Gregorio Casillas decided to join him. But eventually, when the Bracero program ended, Casillas knew that he had to come here without papers. And he did so, and he started working first in the fields, picking up tomatoes. And then he managed to move to Los Angeles, where he became a carpenter. And in 1962, Gregorio Casillas and some other friends were having breakfast in a small restaurant at the time called Las Delicias. And they started talking about the old people that still lived back home in Mexico.
They talked about how the money they sent back could help these people and build up the towns they were from. They organized a club and fundraisers to send more money back.
Eventually, they started to throw massive parties. Parties would begin at 8 a.m. They would end up at around 2 a.m. And as they roared on, people built a sense of community in the United States. The club that Gregorio Casillas started managed to introduce potable water, electricity
in the town,
To pave the street, to fence the church. These remittances changed whole communities.
And Minian was struck by how silent politicians in Mexico were when it came to undocumented migration, men especially leaving the country increasingly in the 1970s and especially in the late 80s.
When the problem of undocumented migration really starts in the 1970s, there was in some ways an active role of the Mexican government of not speaking about the issue of migration, because they knew that this was an embarrassment. Government officials knew that the large numbers of people who were having to go to a place where they were considered illegal meant that Mexico was failing to incorporate them. So they took an active policy of silence.
While Mexicans in the U.S. sent billions home to support their families and towns, and that official silence in Mexico continued through the late 80s and beyond, when the U.S. tightened immigration laws and the border and when that cross-border coming and going slowed way down.
They continue coming to the United States, but once they're here, they don't risk going back to Mexico only to have to come back to the United States. Instead, they settle permanently here without papers. And not only that, but they encourage their wives and their children, who previously had not for the most part migrated, to move north and remain here with them without papers.
Minion calls this part of her book The Golden Cage.
It starts with a song from Los Tigres del Norte, a very famous norteño band. And one of their songs is called La Jaula de Oro, or the Cage of Gold.
De mi México querido, del que yo nunca me olvido, y no puedo regresar. ¿De qué me sirve el dinero si estoy como prisionero dentro de esta gran nación?
And it talks about this migrant who's living in the United States and dreams of going back to Mexico, but feels entrapped like in a cage that, yes, is made of gold, but he can't leave this country.
And his kids, now in the U.S., who don't want to return.
Escúchame, hijo. ¿Te gustaría que regresáramos a vivir a México?
What you talking about, Dad? I don't want to go back to Mexico. No way, Dad.
Mis hijos no hablan conmigo.
Minion also documents how some migrants began to change their movements in a more policed America.
To try to avoid the places where immigration officials would often hang out. So, for example, they knew that immigration officials would often be at a particular park. And even if it meant walking many more blocks, they would take a very circuitous way back home in order to avoid bumping into these immigration officials.
A reality still true for many immigrants in the U.S. today. And just as Minion was wrapping up her book, Donald Trump campaigned for president.
What Trump's rhetoric reminded me of was that he was talking about a population of individuals who I had interviewed personally, who had come to work, who had made some mistakes like everyone, who had fallen in love and fallen out of love, who had sent money back to Mexico to build their hometowns, and that all of this nuance of humanity was being lost by accusations of their rapists or their bad hombres. But the other thing that it makes me think about is how for a long time, since the 1960s, when we've tried to create at least a language of multiculturalism, we have used the term illegal alien as a proxy for racial animus. So when people used to say he's an illegal alien, what they meant was he's a Mexican. And now they're just saying that more outright.
Minion also thinks about the fact that since 2008, more Mexicans are leaving the U.S. than are coming in, and what this means for a wall at the U.S.-Mexico border, and who is kept in and out today. When you think of the wall, do you think of more than one wall?
Yeah, I don't think of the U.S.-Mexico wall alone, but of all of Mexico acting as a wall, as a border that expands, not just between Mexico and the United States and that particular line, but it also expands further north into the United States where there are border checkpoints that often restrict people from coming in, and all the way south throughout Mexico, where throughout Mexico there are checkpoints that prevent Central Americans from coming. And they're doing so because of the horrible economic, political, and violent conditions in their home countries. So while the United States talks about building a wall between Mexico and the United States that will actually affect Central Americans more than Mexicans, Mexico is preventing and is trying to stop the flow of Central Americans to the United States and, in effect, doing the work that the wall is already doing.
Historian Ana Raquel Minion, speaking there with the world's Monica Campbell. Minion's book is called Undocumented Lives. Coming up, another story from the Central American Migrant Trail to America's egg farms. That's next, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. A few years ago, eight teenagers from Guatemala found themselves in Ohio, working at a massive egg farm. They sometimes worked 16-hour days in hen houses that got up to 90 degrees and came home to tiny trailers with little food, no toilet, and no running water. The teens were some of the thousands of unaccompanied minors who crossed the border into the U.S. back in 2014. And once here, these teens got caught up in a labor trafficking ring. Daffodil Altan is a producer for Frontline and the investigative reporting program at UC Berkeley. She co-produced Trafficked in America, which airs tonight on most PBS stations. So, Daffodil, the documentary focuses on about 8 teenagers from the same area in Guatemala. Tell us a little bit about them, and how did you find them, first of all?
This is the story of a group of teenagers who were part, actually, of a bigger criminal labor trafficking case who were all being forced to work against their will on an Ohio egg farm. We made contact with several of them, but not all of them, because a lot of them are still in protective custody. They're traumatized. They don't want to talk. But the ones that we did speak to, we went to their villages back in Guatemala. And where they live, there is no state presence. They're sort of self-policed communities, isolated. And people really, really struggling to feed their families. I mean, you don't know if you're going to eat day to day. And so you have a situation where you have young men who are wanting to work, who are wanting to go to school and just aren't able to. And so they're in a desperate situation and they decide to take these very risky journeys for this very abstract dream because they are so desperate for any kind of financial security.
These teenagers were smuggled across the border by a man named Aroldo Castillo, but most of them didn't have the money to pay him for the journey across. What was the deal that they had to make to get into the U.S.?
Well, that's a situation that they and many people get into. You don't have U.S. dollars. You don't have a way to pay a fee that can range from $6,000 to $15,000. This particular recruiter slash smuggler, what he would propose is, you don't have this money, so give me the deed to any property that you have. And in exchange for that, I will get you or your child to the U.S., and then they will work that debt off over a period of years. Now, of course, you don't have any control over interest or how long you have to pay that debt back. So that's how he was able to control and manipulate these teenagers.
We should remember that you were filming in 2014, the year that the number of unaccompanied minors from Central America coming to the U.S. reached its peak. And the Department of Health and Human Services was supposed to place these teenagers with relatives or an adult sponsor, but they were overwhelmed. How did the vetting standards just start slipping?
One of the things we found was that the normal procedure for placing a child with a sponsor, your ID is verified, your birth certificate is verified, where you live is verified, you do background checks. And so all of these standards started slowly being relaxed because they felt like they just had to get the children placed and out. And one of the things they haven't done, to the best of our knowledge in terms of our reporting, is tracking and following up with these sponsors and their placements. And so you can have an initial placement that seems like it's a relative or someone who knows the child. But if you never check up on them, you don't know whether that person actually is a relative, whether the child is being exploited. They weren't seeing the red flags in terms of having sponsors who were, for example, getting 6 children released to them. Well, should there be a flag there? Should you go check that person's home out? Should you go see where these children are ending up? Now, Health and Human Services has said that they have improved their vetting standards and their placement standards. But as far as we know, there is not tracking data that's publicly available.
So how did the abuses at the farm come to light?
One of the things that happened in this case that is unusual is that someone actually spoke out. And when you're looking at labor trafficking, one of the reasons it's so hard to identify is because victims don't always necessarily know that they are victims, or if they're being coerced or threatened, they're not going to speak up. What happened in this situation is that one of the teenage boys, who was so fed up and got here and was sort of shocked by the work conditions, the living conditions, and when he asked to leave the job, his father was threatened back in Guatemala. He had the courage to call an uncle that he had here who was living in Florida. And this uncle was also undocumented, but risked his own status and called the local sheriff. And so that boy's initial phone call is what started the domino effect.
What about the teenagers? How'd they end up? How are they doing?
The ones that we were able to find and establish some kind of relationship with, most of them have now gotten what is called a T visa. It's a visa that you can get that will allow you to stay here if it's confirmed that you've been a victim of human trafficking. So they receive those visas. Some of them have graduated high school. Some of them are working and, you know, still very nervous about, because their families are still back in Guatemala, they're still very nervous about repercussions from the people who trafficked them, who had them in this forced labor situation. So despite now having legal permission to be here, they still live with the trauma.
Daffodil Altan, co-producer of the Frontline documentary Trafficked in America, airing tonight on PBS. Daffodil, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
A couple of minutes now before we take a short break. So let me share this crazy weather news with you out of Kenya. Large portions of this East African country are dealing with serious flooding right now after weeks of heavy rains. Thousands of Kenyans have had to leave their homes. My BBC colleague Mercy Juma is in Nairobi.
The floods are happening in about 70% of Kenya. But when we talk about the mudslides, this is specifically the eastern part of the country. These are regions that normally are very dry regions, but with the rains, it's become terrible. Today in Nairobi, there are so many areas which are impassable. We have people who've been stuck in traffic for hours on end. We have vehicles which are being washed away on the way to Nairobi when coming from Mombasa. So the flooding is almost all over the country. The Kenya Red Cross says that as of now, they're looking at evacuating about 150,000 people. And earlier on, we talked to Abbas Gulet, who is the head of the Kenya Red Cross. And he says three dams are already full to capacity and are overflowing. So they are looking at ways to move people who live around those dams away from those areas. And where the rivers are breaking banks, people have to climb on top of trees to make the phone calls that would save their lives.
Incredible. Those heavy rains are not the only factor leading to the flooding. There is also a growing demand in the country for wood, which is used for cooking and construction. Juma says that's led to widespread deforestation.
As you drive away from Nairobi down to Western Kenya, this is a place that initially, the last maybe 3-4 years, was lined with beautiful trees. You would be driving down and this is beautiful scenery. But when you go down nowadays, what you see is just tree stumps. Trees have been cut down. People are busy logging. And sadly, the areas where this has happened the most is also the most affected, like the Narok region, just 2 hours away from Nairobi, where there has been massive flooding. We are seeing the grounds cracking and rifts happening because of deforestation.
The BBC's Mercy Juma keeping an eye on heavy flooding all over Kenya today. She was speaking there from Nairobi. I'm Marco Werman. Publicly, she was an ABC journalist covering post-revolutionary Cuba.
And now, an interview with Fidel Castro.
But behind the scenes, there was a lot more to her work.
She became the most significant back channel between Washington and Havana in 1963 and 1964.
Lisa Howard's story, that's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. It was a scene that would have shaken any police officer, veteran or rookie, and it happened on the crowded streets of downtown Toronto yesterday afternoon. A van driver went on a rampage on city streets and sidewalks, running down numerous pedestrians. Dozens of casualties lay on the sidewalk, dead and injured. Canadian police officers responded, encountering the suspect a few blocks away. Cameras caught the moment a policeman confronted the suspect, who was holding something in his hand and repeatedly pointing it at the officer.
Come on, get down! Kill me!
That's the suspect yelling, "Kill me! I have a gun in my pocket." The cop says, "I don't care. Get down." Then the officer manages to subdue and handcuff the suspect. Gary Clement is a former Royal Canadian Mounted Police superintendent. What stood out to you watching this video of the suspect yesterday being apprehended, Gary?
It was clear to me that just based on the actions of the individual and how he was doing it, he was looking for what they often term suicide by cop. But the reality of it is the officer had a front seat view of what he was holding in his hand, and I am led to believe it was probably a cell phone. So he took appropriate action. He de-escalated the situation by refusing to shoot him. And it showed the maturity of an officer and the appropriate action under the circumstances.
And listening to the sound there, it sounds like the suspect is asking the police to shoot him. You talked about suicide by cop. Have you actually seen that in your 34 years of policing?
You do. I mean, a few individuals are looking to exit after they've done something, and their way out is they can't commit suicide, so they will use a police officer as the means to exit this earth. And it's unfortunate, but that's a reality.
It has to be said, there have been numerous problems surrounding police shootings in Canada over the years. Officers are not immune from criticism of being too quick to pull the trigger. Similar thing here. But is the training Canadian officers receive in restraint and de-escalating conflicts, is that training different than what officers are likely to receive in the U.S.?
Well, I think we've come to a realization. I say we. I was a former chief of police as well for 4 years. And, you know, unfortunately, the training that was provided at that time for a number of years all centered around what option of use of force do you use? And there wasn't enough emphasis on de-escalation. Because of some very unfortunate events that have occurred, what we're seeing now is officers are being trained in how to de-escalate a situation. And as a result, you know, I think we're going to see a little more restraint on the part of officers. The bottom line is the test is supposed to be an officer has to fear for his life, his or her, I should say. And if you can't make that claim, then the best thing is to use probably the biggest weapon you got, and that's your mind and your mouth.
Do you think there's a different calculus for American police officers in that there's just a greater likelihood the subject here in the States will be armed?
I traveled in the States a lot and have spoken over the years with a lot of U.S. officers. There is some difference. I mean, we're starting to see an explosion of firearm incidents in Canada. That definitely changes the approach of police officers. I mean, there's more concern. United States, so you are different culturally when it comes to firearms. And as a result of that, there is the presence of far more firearms. You know, the ones that police officers today will see in a community of restricted firearms, that we call them restricted handguns, et cetera, they, for the most part, are illegal weapons. So we know that the individual has got it for an illegal purpose. That's not the same in the United States, and I think that's where we have to draw the line.
I got to say, for a lot of Americans, it was really striking to hear this dialogue between the police in Toronto and this killer yesterday. What is still lacking, though, in the training in Canada for these kinds of situations?
I've got a young daughter that works with family issues, and she deals with a lot of individuals that are challenged and families that are, you know, torn apart by problems with children. And you know, she's learned to de-escalate. I wish police officers had the type of training and ability that she's acquired, because they know when they walk into places, and they walk into places that police officers wouldn't go in by themselves. They walk in by themselves, and they know how to de-escalate. They know how to talk to people. And I think that all police officers in North America need a higher level of training, you know, along the same lines that, you know, when I started, we didn't have this body of various weapons that we could pull out as use of force items. You know, we had a revolver and our head. And we learned very early on that your best weapon was your ability to talk to people.
Gary Clement is a former Royal Canadian Mounted Police Superintendent. He's now the CEO of the Clement Advisory Group. Thanks very much.
Thank you, and have a great day.
Donald Trump's pick for the job of Secretary of State has taken a big step closer to confirmation. Late last night, Mike Pompeo, currently serving as Director of Central Intelligence, won approval from a key U.S. Senate committee.
He's going to be probably one of the most formidable, one of the most interesting secretaries of state we've had in years.
That's Sean Steele with the Republican National Committee in California. So what makes Pompeo special? Here's what Steele told the BBC.
What makes him special in two senses. One, he has the complete trust of Trump, and they created a joint view of the world situation. And so Trump invested a great deal of trust in that. And if you're going to be a successful secretary of state, you've got to be close to the president.
One person who's not so convinced about Pompeo is Robert Menendez from New Jersey. He's a top Democrat on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. There was a sense, Senator, that Pompeo was not going to get approval from the committee last night. What happened?
Well, one member on the Republican side, Senator Rand Paul, had said he was definitely going to vote against him. And then, I guess after significant lobbying by the president and the White House, he switched.
Yeah, and what seemed to happen between Trump and Rand Paul, Senator Rand Paul, was how much does Pompeo actually believe the Iraq War was a mistake? And Trump insisted that he did and does believe the Iraq War is a mistake. Pompeo also says he wants to pull troops out of Afghanistan now. But if you look at his track record over the years, calling Pompeo a hawk is not an exaggeration. What are we supposed to believe of what this man believes?
Well, that's the actual question that I posed at the end of his nomination hearing, and as I framed why I was voting no on Pompeo yesterday in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. You know, is it the Mike Pompeo who's talked about regime change in various parts of the world? Or is it the one who would pursue robust diplomacy? Is it the one who will internally push back on the president's worst instincts or facilitate it? And so based on a record, as well as his answers, it just seemed to me that the Mike Pompeo will have as the Secretary of State is not the robust diplomatic adventurer who will actually suppress or seek to advise the president strongly to use diplomacy versus military action, and who also has made comments about different communities in the past that a good part of the world represents, whether that's the Muslim community, Indians, LGBTQ communities. And so if you're going to promote democracy and human rights across the globe, you have to start by observing him, observing it here at home.
Now, there are some troubling aspects of Pompeo that you've cited, other lawmakers have too. I'm talking about how he speaks about Muslim leaders in America and their quote-unquote special obligation, as he calls it, to preventing terrorist attacks on American soil. What did he say about that in the hearings?
Well, he never took the opportunities that were presented to him by various members, including myself, to either show regret, to say that he was mistaken. He, you know, basically skirted those issues.
It is really hard to imagine someone at this level of American politics making similar comments about any other major religious group. Why is this not a bigger deal?
Well, it should be a big deal. And that is one of the most significant reasons, in addition to an inability to speak to strategy on the critical fronts in the world that we face, whether it be a Russia, Iran, North Korea, Venezuela, whether it be his truthfulness and forthcoming on both his unwillingness to discuss the interview he had with Bob Mueller about Russia, which is a critical issue before the committee, or not disclosing his North Korea visit, either in public or in a classified setting when he was being asked questions about North Korea. So this is a significant issue, one of several that has led every Democrat on the committee to vote no.
Senator Menendez, there are rules and protocol when it comes to diplomacy, but at the end of the day, if we look at history, all kinds of diplomatic rules have been broken in order for peace to succeed. Do you agree with that? And do you think Pompeo offers some hope of unconventional diplomacy?
Look, if Director Pompeo gets confirmed through the full Senate, I certainly will seek to work with him, and I wish him the best in the mission. That's, we want America to succeed. We want the world to be safer. As a matter of fact, our concerns about Director Pompeo is that he rounds out what some consider to be a war cabinet versus a cabinet that seeks peace in our time. And so I certainly would hope that they can achieve that success. But it's interesting to send the director of the CIA, who has talked about regime change in North Korea, as the opening gambit of a conversation with North Korea's dictator.
Senator Robert Menendez, thanks very much for your time today. Really appreciate
it. Good to be with you.
Speaking of diplomacy, lots of pomp and circumstance today in Washington as President Trump welcomed French President Emmanuel Macron on day two of his official visit. It'll be topped off with a big state dinner tonight at the White House. Now, we've been hearing a lot about the friendship that Macron seems to have with Trump. There was one story in the French newspaper, Le Monde, that stood out. Donald Trump has been cutting out positive press clippings about Macron and sending them to him, along with little handwritten notes saying things like, "Great job." But here's the interesting bit. These notes are getting sent to Macron through the diplomatic pouch. I know, almost sounds too good or odd to be true. Anyway, we wanted to find out more about that pouch. Barbara Bodine is a former U.S. ambassador to Yemen. She's now the director of the Institute for the Study of Diplomacy at Georgetown University. So, Ambassador, what the heck is a diplomatic pouch?
A diplomatic pouch is really just a canvas mailbag.
It has to be canvas?
It doesn't have to be canvas. And actually, diplomatic pouches are no longer pouches. They can be trucks. They can be shipping crates. They are escorted by a diplomatic courier. Governments are not supposed to open them or x-ray them or otherwise tamper with them. And so they're very secure, and it's a core part of diplomacy, although some of it, of course, has been overtaken by email and internet and more modern things like that.
So have there ever been any instances where the diplomatic pouch was used to transport illicit items?
Yes. Like everything, it can be abused. It's been used probably to bring in a lot of Cuban cigars into the United States. It's been used, unfortunately, sometimes to transport weapons. We had one unfortunate incident where we had an American ambassador who was shipping in cocaine for personal use. It's also been used to smuggle spies out
of
countries. Like actual human beings.
That would have to be a big pouch.
It's a big pouch or a very uniquely shaped crate.
And how did those instances work out?
Well, we got the people out. We got a couple of people out of the Soviet Union that way.
Wow.
People have also been kidnapped by more hostile governments and sometimes shipped out. None of these are covered by the Vienna Convention, I can assure you, as normal uses for the pouch.
I'm sure. So why would a sitting U.S. president use it to send press clippings? I mean, if we're to believe Le Monde, this is what Trump is doing for Macron, sending these clippings.
It's very odd. I mean, first of all, I presume that the French have internet. You can I understand that you can send a link or you can scan it and send it as an email. And if they're press clippings, they're not classified. So I really honestly don't know why the kind of clipping service that my grandmother used to do for me is something that we would need to use the pouch for. It also doesn't quite make sense because you usually use it between your own headquarters and your own embassy. And so he could have taken the clippings over to the French embassy here in Washington and they could have sent them. I presume there may have been some journalistic license in the story, but it otherwise is a very odd way to send information to another head of state.
What was the oddest thing you ever sent via the diplomatic pouch where it was like, yeah, I don't know if I should do this, but I don't really have any other way of getting this out of Yemen?
I very rarely used it. I mean, we don't use the pouch very much anymore. When I was in Baghdad, we used it to get Christmas presents into our families. And that's not exactly a classified communication, but it was the only way that we could ensure that our toys could get to our kids.
You've kind of mentioned this a couple of times, but let me just ask it straight on. Why is the diplomatic pouch not used that much anymore?
Because of modern communication. When I first joined the department, most of our reports to Washington were hard copy, and they were put on a pouch, and then they were taken with a courier and flown all the way to Washington. Now we have classified email and we have classified communications equipment. So you don't really need it as a classified secure mailbag anymore.
Barbara Bodine, the former U.S. ambassador to Yemen, telling us about the diplomatic pouch. Thank you.
You're quite welcome.
A new article in Politico profiles an extraordinary American, actress, journalist, and unofficial diplomat, Lisa Howard. Back in the day, she was a pioneer for women in the all-male world of TV news. Howard became famous for scoops like this.
And now, an interview with Fidel Castro.
That was April 1963. Lisa Howard was the first American journalist to secure an interview with Fidel Castro after the Cuban Missile Crisis and the failed Bay of Pigs invasion. In fact, she developed an intimate relationship with Fidel. Peter Kornbluh wrote the story for Politico. He's director of the Cuba Documentation Project at the National Security Archive at George Washington University. What a life and what a story, Peter. And the details you found are pretty incredible. How significant was that first interview Lisa Howard did with Fidel Castro?
Oh, it was so significant, Marco, because, you know, this was 1963. It was the height of the Cold War. It was literally just a few months after the Cuban Missile Crisis, when the world and certainly U.S. citizens thought they were on the brink of obliteration. And so in some ways, Cuba was a Cold War focal point. And Castro was, you know, depicted in the media, the mainstream press, as the Diablo, the devil incarnate, you know, a communist disciple of Nikita Khrushchev's and turning his country into a Soviet base right off the shore of the United States of America. And Lisa Howard for ABC News worked very hard, persistently pressing to get an interview with Fidel Castro in the spring of 1963. And she had already scored an impressive interview with Nikita Khrushchev a few years earlier, which gained a lot of attention. And now she set her sights on Castro. And this interview that aired in May of 1963 really was one of the first times when the American public got to see a different side of Fidel Castro and an interest that he had in better relations with the United States.
And she pulled no punches in that interview. I want us to just hear one excerpt. The audio quality is not great. It's worth to hear Howard pushing Fidel and him responding in English. Here we go.
Are you telling me, Dr. Castro, that there are no Soviet troops and armaments in Cuban soil?
You call Soviet troops. We call technicals. You understand? And really, they are training our troops. It's clear?
Yeah.
Really, they are training our troops. They are as instructors of our troops. That is the truth.
And they are not Soviet troops themselves?
They are Soviet technicals. I think that if we are attacked, those technicals are going to fight with us.
I know Lisa Howard features prominently in a book you co-authored called Back Channel to Cuba, The Hidden History of Negotiations Between Washington and Havana. So what was her role in that?
She became the most significant back channel between Washington and Havana in 1963 and 1964. She pushed her way in, just willed her way into the all-men's club of international diplomacy. She'd already pushed her way to the top of the all-men's club of journalism, and now she was going to take on the role of being a secret intermediary, a citizen's diplomat, and an acknowledged and used interlocutor between Fidel Castro's office and the Oval Office. And this was her singular accomplishment. She really did build a bridge of communication, a secret channel of communications between Fidel Castro and President Kennedy and then President Johnson after Kennedy was killed. And the story in Politico tells how she built on this, what I call a relationship that was personal and intellectual, as well as intimate, and conducted what I call intimate diplomacy with Fidel Castro and the United States, and actually pushed both countries towards each other into a conversation and a dialogue.
How intimate were they?
Well, they
were they lovers?
You know, the story in Politico starts with this extraordinary scene where Fidel Castro is with her very late at night in her hotel room at the Riviera in February of 1964. She's come back to Cuba for a second time after Kennedy has been assassinated to try and do another special on Cuba, but also to talk to Fidel of how they're going to revive the secret diplomacy that they were doing with John F. Kennedy that has now died along with him. And when she first arrives, he comes to see her at midnight, and they actually have a discussion. I mean, they start to go down the road toward consummating their relationship, and then he says, "No, you know, you've written about us. You are working on, you know, improving relations. If we go to bed together, we will ruin this relationship." And he says it's not going to happen now. He really chooses at that moment the broader national interests of his country.
Is that moment where he says we would be great together, but we would have many fights, 100 fights, but in the end it would all be – is that the one?
No, Marco, truth be told, that is what he says to her after they actually have gone to bed together.
Oh, okay. So they did consummate the relationship.
Yes, about a week later.
You know, I've got to ask you this. I mean – she crossed the line as a journalist, relaying information to the White House. Did her feelings for Castro lead her in that direction, or do you think she was never really committed to journalism. She just wanted adventure.
Oh, I think much differently than you do. I think she was very committed to journalism. But I think she was very committed to the philosophers that she had read, Camus, Kant, and others that she frequently quoted, that, you know, that an individual could make a tremendous difference. And she saw the need for the United States and Cuba not to go down the road, continue down the road towards aggression in the aftermath of the missile crisis. And she saw an opportunity that she had to convince first President Kennedy and the Kennedy White House and then Lyndon Johnson and the Johnson White House that there should be an ongoing dialogue with Cuba, that Castro was not the implacable foe and a hardcore communist. And so I think she made her contribution, her intimate diplomacy, as I call it, you know, did have an impact on the course of the Cold War in the early 60s. But more than that, it set a model for future back-channel diplomacy, and it began to pave the historical road that more than half a century later Barack Obama decided to follow in his back-channel diplomacy with Raul Castro that led to a breakthrough in relations.
Peter Kornbluh, he's director of the Cuba Documentation Project at the National Security Archive at George Washington University. Always good to talk, Peter. Thank you.
It's always good to talk, Marco.
And that'll do it for us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Back with you all tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.